Atlanta right now. I'm taking my savings and I'm getting a plane ticket down to Atlanta.
Man, it's disgusting that you think about how Florida. Oh, it's. I mean, you look at Florida's team that they won with today. Yeah, are you are you kidding me?
Well, look at Florida. I mean, and if you really want to twist the knife in that wound, if we hold on to Florida like we should, because we had them 4th and 13. Forget everything else. We had them 4th and 13, and then our DBs forgot how to take angles to the ball. But if we hold them on that 4th and 13. That's not just our season, but that's Florida's season, because you could see it the next week. They built confidence off of that win.
Absolutely.
After that come behind win, I mean, they cruised to their next two games just off of that game alone.
Hey, wonderful phone call, Sean. Thank you, man. Great hearing from you in Cali.
Hey, thanks, Tony. Hey, appreciate the show, man. I love it out here.
Hey, thank you so much. I want to remind you, I'm back with the 11-1 on Monday. Race fans, race fans, race fans. Dubsy Smith launches his show 3 o'clock at 13:40. And where is it online, Dubsy, for the thousands and thousands and thousands listening right now?
SportsRadioKnoxville.com is the website, and you can listen on the TuneIn Radio app.
So check it out. Jerry Colquitt on the way out. Who does Seattle have tomorrow?
Dallas Cowboys, Orange Juice Jones. If you're listening, what jersey are you going to wear tomorrow? Your Dallas Cowboy jersey or that Cam Chancellor jersey that I sent you?
Juicy's got a decision to make. Something tells me knowing Juicy that Juicy's going to wear his Dallas Cowboy jersey.
Juicy Locke?
No, his brother, Orange Juice Jones. Ah. He saw you and him walking in the rain.
I like the Eric Locke package making an appearance tonight.
And it really worked.
Jennings. Yeah.
Yeah, he got bulldogged to the ground.
Hashtag tradition.
It is tradition. When we throw that guy back around the Wildcat, it does not work in our offense.
He's going to run it straight up the middle and get stuffed for about a 2-yard loss.
It's a lot of fun. Jerry on
Tell
me. Do you watch it?
Wait, Tony. I was going to say, tell me, I know you got nervous when we were on the goal line and we went shotgun.
2015 college football. Gotta love it.
Yep. Everybody lines up on the shotgun.
Stanford's on the goal line here. You can bet they won't be lining up in the shotgun. They'll line up under center with about three fullbacks in the backfield.
Jerry, give me go ahead, Jerry. No, go ahead.
I was gonna say, you know what's crazy is, I mean, within our league, there's still 4 teams that are doing quite well that still play that way. You know, the rest of the 8 have kind of gone to this one back, primarily shotgun stuff. But then you got Georgia that plays a mix. Right now, Florida plays a mix. They play most of that stuff from under center. They'll hand it deep to the back out of the a deep set. And you got Arkansas and you got LSU. So, you know, it seems like some of the teams have kind of gone to the wayside there, but you still got a handful that are still playing some traditional football. It's kind of nice to see.
It is, and I think the pendulum's going to swing back around. But spread's having its day right now. Everybody adjusts, though. They'll figure out a way to stop it. And it's going to be a lot of fun. Hey, look, it looks like it's running out of steam down there at Auburn already.
Like it's a recruiting tool more than anything else. I mean,
yeah. You know who Mike Leach looks like? It's like a homeless Vince Gill. Like a dazed and confused, battered, weathered Vince Gill.
It is uncanny.
Look at him.
Wow.
Somebody
watching
hand him
this Duke replay. I didn't know Duke lost like this.
Oh, yeah. We were talking about it earlier. Saddest. That's one of the craziest endings. You imagine putting all your work into a game, those kids put into that game, and get beat like that.
What was worse, Duke losing the way they did or Michigan losing against Michigan State the way they did?
Or did you guys see the Texas loss? I think it was the Texas Tech, where Texas is going for the go-ahead score to put the game away.
Yeah.
It was about two or three minutes left, and they have that
botched
awesome mistake on special teams to get what they get a block field goal attempt. They run it back. I mean, that's just got to be crushing, man.
There's been a lot of that in college football this year. Been a lot of that. Well, guys, Dubsy, give me a final thought here on the way out. We've reached the 2 o'clock hour here on the East Coast.
It was just a solid win. You did what you had to do. And I know some people, I saw some of this on Twitter, Tennessee hasn't beaten anybody yet. Yeah, but they haven't.
What does that mean?
Well, they haven't lost anybody yet either.
That's exactly right.
You know, the four losses are all to quality programs. They were in all those games. They didn't get blowed out
exactly
in any
right.
of those ball games. So, you know, it's you're making progress. He won 5 regular season games his first year, 6 regular season games his second year. He's going to win at least 7 this year, if not 8. So, you're moving on up.
Jerry, final thought on the way out with South Carolina in here next week, 4 o'clock Eastern start.
And I haven't seen a lick of tape, not even one.
Not a lick.
On it, but I'll say this, if you go just in and look at some of the highlights, some of the scores, don't sleep on this team. I mean, it's almost like they've been rejuvenated somehow, be it, you know, the departure of their coach. And maybe this team just kind of, you know, coming together collectively. Cause they can't, if you think about how good they have been, they can't be that bad all of a sudden.
Totally agree.
To me, it's somewhere in between, and this is a game that Tennessee can't sleep on. And, you know, this team, South Carolina, they've had a history of, more of a successful history against us than we have them as of recent. So, you know, they're not scared of us, so I just hope these guys, you know, they bring it in and they're extremely focused this week. This could totally be a trap game.
Jerry, thank you. Hope you have a great night and a beautiful carry on, my friend, in FEMA Region 10. Thank you, brother.
All right, Tony.
All right, and the North American Union NWO is alive and well. Dubsy, thanks, man. Give me one more plug for your radio show and what you're doing, brother, on the way out.
Yeah, man. The Drive moves to Fox Sports Radio Knoxville starting Monday, which I guess is now tomorrow, 3 to 6 a.m. 1340 here in town, online, sportsradioknoxville.com, and your TuneIn radio app.
And it's 2 a.m., which means it's quitting time for us. We love you. Go Vols. We're getting back. Tennessee 52-21 over the Mildcats up in beautiful Lexington. For all the Volcats, I hope you're having a nice ride back. We don't claim you. It is your season. It is your time. Do what you're going to do, but you're not a Tennessee fan. And for the rest of the Tennessee fans, I say it was wonderful. Thank you for the opportunity to serve you tonight. To that football team, I say congratulations. God bless. And go Volunteers. Enjoy your Sunday. So pleased to have with us Brian Toohey, no stranger to the program. His new book out called A Season in the Abyss, Sports Gambling versus the NFL's Integrity. And Brian Toohey, if you'll remember, is the gentleman who has authored a book in the past called The Fix Is In, The Showbiz Manipulations of the NFL, Major League Baseball, NBA, NHL, and NASCAR. Brian Toohey's been published in places like Sports Illustrated, Bleacher Report, Sports on Earth, Vice Sports. And Brian Toohey, I welcome you in. It is always good to talk with you, my friend.
It's always good to talk to you too, Tony.
Why did you decide to turn your focus on the NFL when it comes to just putting them under the microscope?
Well, the NFL is the biggest and baddest sports league we have in America. The stats say that over 200 million Americans watched at least part or all of one NFL game last year. And that's the one you got to look at when you look at the integrity and what these businesses are really up to. So I took the NFL to task because it really bothers me that they led this fight to stop New Jersey from legalizing sports gambling. Yet at the same time, I knew to a certain extent that they were profiting from people gambling on their sport. So what I decided to do and why I wrote the book was that I spent all of last season doing exactly what the NFL says it didn't want me to do. I went out and gambled on the NFL in every way, shape, and form I could possibly find. Tried to explain to readers what this meant, how to, not necessarily how to do it in terms of winning and losing your bet, but how you can go about betting on the NFL, and then what it really means to the league, and how much people are involved in betting as they are in watching the sport.
And you got right to it in the very beginning. The very, very, very first chapter, you deal with the NFL's concerted effort to squash gambling in the state of New Jersey. And for those that didn't follow the story, New Jersey voters or residents woke up one day and thought that it was home free, that sports gambling was going to become a part of what they were doing there. Chris Christie, the governor there, they wanted it. Lo and behold, the NFL steps in through the power of their lobby, and they squash it.
Well, and first of all, thanks for reading the book. Most radio hosts won't take time to actually crack open the book if you send it to them, so thanks for that. But in terms of your actual question with the NFL, yeah, they are actually deputized, believe it or not, by the federal government. The NFL, NCAA, Major League Baseball, all of them are deputized by the law that keeps sports gambling from spreading in the United States. So when New Jersey attempted to legalize this, it was really up to the NFL and the other leagues to sue to stop them and prevent them from doing it. And that's exactly what they did. And the funny part I find, and why I relate it to the league's integrity so much, is Roger Goodell claimed, even in his declaration that he submitted to the federal court over this whole thing, is that they're afraid of fans turning from being just rah-rah for the home team into gamblers. They're afraid every fan's going to become a gambler if sports gambling is legalized, and that fans are going to care more about the point spread, who beat the point spread or who beat the under over, than they are going to care about who won or lost and what that means to their home team. And it's very ironic because at the same time, this is the league that literally helped create what's now known as daily fantasy sports, which is a complete gambling entity, even though the law says it's not. And yet now many fans are watching and only care about what their players are doing and really don't care about who wins or loses. It's really ironic that on one hand they can say, we don't want you gambling because we're afraid you're not going to really care about who wins or loses, but yet play fantasy sports, and that way you'll care about every game and care about the players, but you really won't care about who wins or loses or the final score. You'll just care about what your fantasy team does.
Yeah, you had a quote here from a Senator Lesniak who talks about the NFL, and he's right. Basically, he says the NFL is not going to allow gambling till they can figure out a way to profit from it. And I had a vision. I think one day in our country, I think like a lot of things, I think a lot of prohibitions are disappearing the further time goes along. And as I read your book, I had this thought. You know, when I go to the horse racing track, Keeneland, for instance, you can go to the betting window, you can bet on the action you're about to see. It's part of the thrill of being there. But you also watch the ponies run and enjoy the nice day outside. What the NFL does, Brian, is so tied to gambling. It obviously, it's fueled by gambling. College football benefits greatly from gambling as well, whether they want to admit it or not. One day, will we be able, the only place you could bet on a game legally outside of the state of Nevada would be in an NFL stadium. I bet you they would go for that. What do you think?
I think it would definitely be on the radar. I mean, it's funny because when they play in Wembley Stadium in England, as they do now three times a year, inside Wembley Stadium, you can bet on the soccer games that are played there, right there at the stadium. But the NFL closes down the betting windows there when they play their game.
You can walk right up to the window in Wembley Stadium and place a bet, just like you do at a horse track.
Exactly. And you can do that at many soccer stadiums around in Europe and elsewhere in the world. But I think what the NFL has and what they have to do is they have to hang on to this integrity idea, which is kind of what the whole book is about. And that is they can say, look, we don't want people gambling, and if any sort of scandal or anything occurs gambling-related, they can always fall back and say, look, we didn't want this. We didn't want it to happen. We did our best to keep it out. You know, they have a great way to write it off. What the NFL really needs is to lose in court. They need the state of New Jersey to win. And then it becomes legal by no hand of the NFL, so the NFL cannot seem so disingenuous, and then they can do their 180 turnaround and start offering gambling left, right, and everywhere. Because they know, like you said, this is what helps fuel the interest in the sport.
Where is that? Where is the case and all that stuff?
The NFL and the leagues are winning. I mean, the state of New Jersey is still fighting it, but really they took a huge hit. They got it all the way almost to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court refused to hear the case because basically every court ruling below them all ruled in favor of the NFL and the major leagues, that the law that was passed by Congress is constitutional. It can stop states from legalizing sports gambling. And without any sort of debate, really, between the courts on this decision, there's nothing for the Supreme Court to rule upon. So I think once the Supreme Court kind of squashed it, it's really kind of faded again, and maybe, who knows, in a year or two it'll crop back up. But right now it's kind of a dead issue, I think.
Brian Tuohy is our guest. A Season in the Abyss is the name of the book. Sports Gambling versus the NFL's Integrity. Brian Tuohy spells his name T-U-O-H-Y. This book available wherever fine books are sold. Amazon.com. Let's talk here about these fantasy deals that you'd mentioned before. This is kind of a new thing in this book, in the chapter on that. Talk about how the NFL has semantically danced around what this really is, which is gambling. They've now gotten it through a loophole where they call it a game of skill. Doesn't really make much sense to me. I could say that if I have the ability to pick a winner in a certain game, it would take just as much skill as trying to figure out what four or five players would be the most productive this week on a lineup. From your research, this fantasy sports stuff for profit, you said before that the NFL is really tied to it. If you could elaborate.
Well, the NFL created the monster that is now this daily fantasy sports. Without direct putting money into it, I mean, DraftKings and FanDuel, the two big names that are out there, they came about because the NFL's lobbyist got a little exemption put into a law called the Unlawful Internet Gambling Enforcement Act, which was passed in 2006. And that basically made it illegal for any credit card company or bank to transfer money between a person and a gambling site. And that really what shut down all the major poker websites that were out there. So a lot of these guys went into daily fantasy sports, but in that little exemption, it says that fantasy sports are a game of skill and not luck, therefore it's not gambling. It's four sentences long, and that's really what it says. And because of that exemption, fantasy sports has exploded. These companies have come out of nowhere to be really billion-dollar industries, and now we've seen, because they're not gambling and because there's no oversight, no government oversight, no other oversight, you've seen daily fantasy sports now have this huge scandal which just erupted, where basically guys working at these companies were using inside information to play at other daily fantasy websites and literally win millions of dollars. So you see what happens when you don't have any oversight on this sort of gambling. And it's the same thing with gambling on games. If you legalize sports gambling, you'd get all the bookies out from underneath the rocks, you'd bring them out into the light, you'd have some oversight, and you know what? We probably would see a lot of scandals, but it would actually help regulate the industry and bring everything above the board. It'd be great, really, for everybody involved.
You make a wonderful point about buyer beware when it comes to these sites here, these daily fantasy sites, because I don't know who I'm playing against. I don't know whether it's rigged. There's a lot of trust going on there. And then you make a point about offshore gambling, which still goes on. Because essentially with this prohibition, you're forcing people to seek other outlets because they're going to gamble. People are going to gamble, just like people are going to use drugs. People are going to gamble. They're going to use drugs. Just like during the Prohibition days, people were going to drink alcohol. People are going to do what people are going to do. Furthermore, the point you make, though, is just because I'm gambling offshore and I win a game doesn't necessarily mean I'm going to get paid. These people we're doing business with here, a lot of times, aren't the most reputable of folks. That is true, yes?
Oh, totally. Because none of it's regulated, and like you say, because there's a prohibition on a lot of it, it forces people who want to do these activities into the hands of outright criminals. Every bookie, whether he's a nice guy or not, is a criminal. He's breaking the law. He knows that. The guys who run the offshore sports books, they know that if they're taking bets from American gamblers, they're breaking the law. They know they're criminals. And because there's no oversight outside of perhaps the FBI coming in and busting out doors and arresting people who are doing this, you as the person trying to gamble at one of these sites is putting a lot of faith and trust into a criminal, into the criminal's hands, and saying, great, I won $1,000 on this game, now pay me. The website can easily say no. And what are you going to do, fly to Costa Rica to get your money back? Fly to Antigua? Figure out where these guys are actually based and located out of, and get your money out of them. Dealing with local bookies, guys you may know sometimes aren't necessarily the easiest to get money back out of. They're quick to ask for the money you owe them, but it's not easy to get the money back out. And with the daily fantasy websites, again, no regulation. And we've already seen it, like I say, just blow up and how these guys are operating, but you don't know who's on the other end of all these other accounts that are out there enlisted.
Yep.
You don't know if it's members of these websites
Yep.
You don't know if it's regular people. You don't know if they're ghost accounts. You have no clue. So, again, you're just hoping that because you see it on TV and because it's backed by Fox Sports and NBC Sports and ESPN and everybody else, you assume it's above the board, but that doesn't mean it is.
You draw a parallel in your book between the way they dangle this out in front of the sports public and the way that the slot machine folks dangle what they do out in front of the retirees that like to sit in casinos all day and play the penny slots. And I was wondering if you could unpack that for me.
The same carrot on a stick in front of everybody, whether it's the slot machines or this daily fantasy thing. The way the daily fantasy things operate, and you've seen the commercials, I'm sure, because you can't get away from them, you can play for free. You can play for just $1 or $2, and hey, maybe you can win $1 million. Doesn't that sound great? It's really easy. Sign up. We'll give you a bonus. We'll match. You put in $200, we'll give you $200. Well, actually, that's not 100% true, because I did FanDuel last year for the book. I put in $50. I actually played the entire season long, the entire NFL season, and I still have a pending bonus of $46 at FanDuel that they haven't paid me, because they don't really match exactly what you put in there. And the same thing goes for DraftKings. They just use these little subtle deceptions. Like I say, you could play for a dollar and potentially win $1 million. But they don't say that the guys who have won $1 million, they don't enter just a lineup. They've literally entered hundreds of lineups into the same event you have. And some of these guys, obviously, as we've seen, they may be working for another daily fantasy website, and so they may know information that you don't know. And it's like I say, it's the same with slot machine. You can play a penny slot machine, and maybe you can win $10,000. The chances of you doing that are very, very slim, and it's the same as the chances of you playing for a dollar and winning $1 million on one of these websites is very, very slim, because you really don't know how stacked against you it really is, because there are professionals who do this all day, every day. I don't know where they get their money from. I don't know how they make so much money doing this thing, but they're out there, and they're preying on just the average Joe, like me last year, who put in $50, and they'll suck the $50 out of you. Maybe you'll be entertained for that money. I don't know. But they're going to take your money, and they're going to profit from it, and most likely you, the average guy, isn't going to make a dime.
Brian Tuohy, A Season in the Abyss, Sports Gambling versus the NFL's Integrity. Brian, one thing that I thought was really interesting was your drilling down into the sports books in Nevada, and the fact that as you went to press with this book, 187 sports books were operating there. $1.74 billion bet on football back in 2014. The International Center for Sports Security says that $152 billion was wagered on the NFL in legal markets outside the U.S. Now think about how much money is flying around on the NFL on a weekly basis. And you went out there to Vegas and were poking around in a few of these places, and they did not like you being there. I was wondering if you could share that with us.
Well, it's funny, because at one place I went to the Westgate, and I was actually able to interview the guy, Jay Cornegay, VP of Sportsbook Operations. And he sat down, and he allowed me to interview him and how the operation worked. But at other places, yeah, I started asking questions of just guys who work the counter. I mean, simple questions, nothing like in-depth and probing, or, you know, asking how your corporation works, but simple questions. And I was told, especially at the M Resort, to literally get out and get out now, or security will escort me out. So it's not, you know, a wide-open thing. I mean, these sports books, all of them, like you said, there's almost 200 of them now in Nevada. Most of them are actually corporate-owned entities. Back in the 60s and 70s, they were all kind of privately owned, like almost like individual bookies who ran them, but now they're corporate entities. A lot of them in Nevada are actually owned and operated by William Hill in the United Kingdom. They don't want to exactly reveal how their operations work. They don't want to tell you exactly what's going on. But I find it frightening that if that report is true, that there's over $150 billion being wagered on the NFL worldwide, and that's like $10 billion a week on NFL games. That's more than the league makes in a season, is being wagered on the game. And then when people say, you know, well, you can't fix an NFL game, you can't corrupt these things, well, wait a second. If there's $10 billion floating around every week on NFL games, somebody's got some serious money to play with. And yes, somebody could easily influence one of these games, because that's a ton of cash.
You start talking about $150 billion. Everybody's looking for an edge. Now, here in this market, on a Friday night, we've had in the past some guy called Fat Jack. I've had a couple of these tout services contact me about, hey, we'd like to run some ads on your... And I've always, since I've been on my own, I have always rebuffed that stuff. First of all, I make a living with college sports, and we have to be very, very careful with that. I've always thought that. not only that, I just don't believe in what they do. And I was right. Your book helped illuminate in chapter 6 when you talk about the touts and the tout services. There is a lot of deception out there, isn't there?
You're right. And it's to your credit that you did rebuke these guys and not allow them to advertise, because they're not on the level. And I was fortunate enough to run into a guy, actually, who's local for me, who used to be a tout. And he kind of explained how he did what he did and why he did what he did. Just think about it. If you somehow get the reputation of being a gambling expert, or you just make yourself into a gambling expert, I mean, let's face it, in today's modern age, you can falsify a lot of stuff. You know, you throw out a couple of Twitter accounts, a couple of Facebook accounts, you can make yourself look like a bigger person than you are. If you offer like a season package like some of these guys do, where, you know, for $200 I'll give you the top five picks every week of the season and blah, 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 my five-star special lock and all these things, you know, you get 1,000 people to sign up for $200 a crack, you made $200,000 without making a single correct pick. These guys can actually make a great deal of money and be 100% wrong on their picks. Now, again, there's no oversight on this either, and I'm not even sure how this is quite legal as it is, because it kind of borders on violating the Wager Wire Act in terms of transferring gambling information over state lines. But the fact is, these guys are able to operate with impunity, and they can be wrong 100% of the time, and it doesn't matter, as long as they keep luring people in saying, oh, you know, I went 7-0 last week. Well, who remembers? Who knows? Where do you have it verified? Well, in most places, it's not. But to a guy who might be desperate, who wants to bet, and he hears this guy seems like he knows what he's talking about, maybe it's worth giving a guy $100, because then maybe I'll make $1,000 off his picks. Well, you know what? You're not. You're going to get screwed, and the other guy's going to make money. And that's the problem with a lot of this gambling.
I love the part of the chapter where you go on and you talk with Brad, who became one of Wayne Allen Root's customers. And Wayne Allen Root, for those not familiar, is an entrepreneur. He's a politician. He's on Bill Cunningham's program, in fact, all the time. Big libertarian guy out in Vegas, has been there forever. He's a best-selling author, but he's smoke and mirrors. His service is smoke and mirrors like the rest of them. Share Brad's experience with Wayne Allen Root, because I think this is part and parcel for what happens in that industry.
Well, exactly, because Brad, the guy who became a tout and who I interviewed, before he became a tout, he was just an average sports bettor, and he decided, like many, I think, sports bettors do, I need some help, I need some advice. So he had read Wayne Allen Root's gambling book and really liked what it said, so he decided to sign up for a service. And he didn't have a lot of money, he was just out of college when he did this, and so the service cost him, like, I want to say, like $1,500, but he did it anyway. And the first guy he talks to, one of Wayne Allen Root's touts, said, all right, here, how much money do you have to work with? And Brad said, I have $2,000. He said, all right, put $500 each on these four college games. And the guy was like, well, wait a second. Brad's like, that's all my money. He goes, oh, don't worry, you know, I guarantee him. Well, he lost all four. And wisely, Brad had recorded the conversation, and he called them back. And he said, look, your guy guaranteed I win these picks. He was wrong on all accounts. I'm out $2,000. I want my money back. I want some sort of satisfaction. And to his own surprise, Wayne Allen Root actually called him, got on the line and said, you know, I'm really impressed that you recorded us and called us on this. I'll give you like $1,000 back if you keep playing with us. And he did. He actually did follow through. But the fact of the matter is, here's a guy who made a guarantee. Yeah, I guarantee these four picks, and he was wrong on all accounts. But that's just the way these guys operate. Unfortunately, it's amazing with the way sports are and how many analytics are out there and how many ways, different ways there are to break down games. People still with the point spreads can't figure out on which side to bet. It's that complex.
There are guys out there, and you hear them make the claim, oh, I'm 75%, I'm 80%. You say there's no way in hell that somebody's 75 or 80%.
Not over a long period of time. A short period of time, sure. Everybody can go on a run. I mean, I chronicle in the book, and I did on my website actually last year, is I picked five games every week, NFL games against the spread. And I wound up hitting about 60% of my picks. And I was picking just crazy. I mean, one week I'd pick all favorites. One week I'd pick all underdogs. One week I'd pick what the touts told me to pick on their free pick giveaways. I mean, I didn't really have any strategy behind what I did. And I managed to hit 60%. Now, I pretty much guarantee if I tried to do that again this year, it wouldn't happen. And that's the same thing with these guys. They can play with their stats, so they're not exactly lying when they say I hit 75%. But it might have been I hit 75% for a month a year ago. And that's the streak I'm promoting. Or, you know, I hit my last five in a row. Well, that may be true, but you don't tell people that you lost the 20 before that. Like I said, the whole shadiness to this tout industry, and what I think should be regulated or somehow barred, because it's just, it's making money off of people and suffering.
And it's really preying off young people.
Exactly.
I thought the statistic you had, that most people that use these services are going to be kids between the ages of 19 and 29, young people.
Well, and that's where a lot of the gambling is, you know, on college campuses and that sort of thing. They have a lot of extra fun money, and they're the ones who are really hardcore sports fans. That maybe as you get older, once you have a family and
yeah.
get a real job and that sort of thing, you know, sports loses that interest for you. But these are people who are gullible. A 19-year-old thinks he knows everything about the world, and if some guy on the radio who's being broadcast by ESPN as being a gambling expert is saying, this is how, you know, you make money by following my picks, and this is my lock of the week, he's going to fall into that trap in a heartbeat, and he's going to be taken for a ride and taken for a lot of money along the way.
Our guest is Brian Toohey. The book is called A Season in the Abyss, Sports Gambling versus the NFL's Integrity. Okay, let's talk about the NFL for a second. We've been talking a lot about sports gambling. The NFL is a league founded by guys that wanted to see the sport of football furthered. They're people that have the community's best interests at heart. They're pillars in the community. Oh, I'm sorry, that's not true. The NFL, by and large, is a sports league funded by gamblers, racketeers, people with ties to organized crime, people who had great days at the racetrack, like the Roonies. Help me unpack that.
Well, it's funny, because Major League Baseball started out really as a gambling sport, that many people forget about that, too. And it wasn't really until the Black Sox scandal in 1919 really changed the atmosphere of what baseball was there for. And it was for gambling. But that whole scandal kind of switched everything. Now, with football, football never had that scandal. But yet it was able to kind of whitewash that gambling history from itself over the years, because I think the NFL wasn't very popular, really, until after World War II. So not many people remembered its history, but the fact of the matter is, the Mara family, Tim Mara, who founded the Giants, was a bookie. I mean, it was legal at the time, but he was an outright bookie. That's what his job was. That's how he made his money. That's how he managed to pay for the New York Giants, was through his bookmaking operation. Art Rooney, founder of the Steelers, was a buddy of Mara's because he used to bet through Mara. That's how he got into the league. In fact, the families are still intertwined to this day. Forget who married who, but there's two actresses out there, one who is just in The Martian. They're family tied to Mara and Rooney. They're tied together, these two entities. Charles Bidwell, whose family still owns the Arizona Cardinals. He was a contemporary of Al Capone. He helped get racketeering money into the Chicago Bears to keep the Chicago Bears afloat, and then the Bears basically forced Bidwell out of town. But they have all these illegal and underground connections that people have forgotten about and ignore.
The NFL, how is it so whitewash its past?
Well, because it sounds bad. Let's face it, if you're a league that says, we don't want people gambling on your game, and then somebody points out, well, the guys who founded this league were all gamblers, and some of the families, like the Rooneys, still own and control racetracks. There's the owner of the Texans. He still owns and races horses. They're involved in gambling. No problem with gambling on a certain level. They just supposedly don't want people gambling on their sport. You can't have it both ways, guys. Either you're totally against gambling and therefore everybody needs to get out of these gambling operations, or you're for gambling and you need to start changing the way you're doing things. But that's the thing. They have the ability, and the media, unfortunately, a lot of times the media is in these pockets of these owners and the league because they don't want to lose access to the league, because that's where their bread and butter is. So they just ignore the past. They put the blinders on and just keep moving forward like it never happened.
There's no doubt that's true. If you look at the way that the concussion issue is covered by those in the league, the Adam Schefters of the world, I mean, they might as well just get on Fidel Goodell's lap and bark for him. And the same with the Spygate thing, which I would say that's a real integrity issue for the league. And you write about that later on in the book. I like what Hugh Culverhouse's son says, and I will quote to you. He says, most of the owners were financially unsophisticated. You got to understand, this league was started by gamblers. There is this facade that these guys are from high society, and no more bullshit could be found. It is a collection of gamblers and rejects.
Yeah. And that's a heck of a quote coming from the guy whose father was an NFL owner.
Yes.
I mean,
doesn't get any better than that.
There, yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't get any better than that, does it?
No, it really doesn't. And, you know, he's right. You could still see the unsophisticatedness within some of these ownership groups. You see how weirdly run Al Davis's son is controlling the Raiders. Who knows what's going on in there? Ziggy Wolf, the guy who owns the Vikings, he was in a lawsuit that lasted some 20 years, and the judge himself said, I think you're running your organization like organized crime. These are guys who don't have the best of backgrounds, yet these are the guys we're falling back on to tell us what integrity means to their league. Well, they have no integrity. But yet, they keep telling us we have to fine these guys, we have to suspend these players, we can't allow the players to do this, we can't allow them to do that because of integrity, yet, you know, don't look at our actual integrity as the owners, because that's a completely different story.
One of the guys that saves the AFL, Sonny Werblin, you talk about how he had tremendous stake in the horse racing industry. And these guys, through time, have punished their own athletes for various gambling activities. I mean, it's a complete hypocrisy what exists when it comes to what's good for the goose in the NFL isn't necessarily always good for the gander.
And what I actually find very strange, and I would like somebody to explain this to me because nobody can explain it, is you can go through, if even just the NFL, it doesn't even include all the other sports, but just the NFL, you can find guys who have been arrested or charged with abusing their spouse, abusing children, drugs, performance-enhancing drugs, illegal drugs, drinking and driving, gun crimes, all sorts of different violations of law all across the board, and yet you cannot find a single NFL player that's gotten in trouble for gambling. Now, how is that possible? How is it possible that none of those guys, and I mean, there's, what, 1,000 guys in the league? How is it that none of them are involved in gambling? Or is it the fact that somehow the NFL is able to keep that buried under the rug? Because there's no way, if you look at the Gamblers Anonymous, if you go to their website, Gamblers Anonymous, and you see what makes for an addicted gambler, potentially addicted gambler, those character traits are exactly what you would want in a professional football player or in a professional athlete, period. And yet we're supposed to believe that none of these guys gamble in any way, shape, or form because the league says you can't. Well, I don't believe that. But, again, because the NFL is so anti-gambling, I think they do a very good job of hiding this sort of thing.
By the way, Brian Toohey's the guest. A Season in the Abyss is the name of the book, Sports Gambling versus the NFL's Integrity. Brian, your website is?
TheFixIsIn.net.
Which is really heartening and delightful thought to kind of chew on. What did we learn about the NFL from the whole Ray Rice incident?
We learned that the league isn't exactly forthcoming with what they know and what they do. I mean, I think, to me, the biggest takeaway is the league has something called NFL Security, which is their own little police force that's literally staffed with guys who used to be in the CIA, the FBI, Secret Service, local law enforcement. I mean, guys who know how to do investigations, and they know how to keep things quiet. And that's why they exist, because NFL Security has never been credited by another law enforcement agency that I've ever seen with helping an investigation. So if they're not there to assist in rooting out criminality from the league and bring it to law enforcement's doorstep to say, hey, this guy's a criminal, you need to get rid of him, then what are they there for besides to keep things quiet? And that's what they tried to do with the Ray Rice thing. They either willfully ignored the videotapes that came from the, you know, the elevator in Atlantic City when the whole thing happened, or they got them and they put them in the same drawer where they put all the Spygate tapes and burnt that one as well. And they thought, I think, they were going to get rid of it. I thought they were going to be able to, you know, eliminate this. It wasn't for TMZ. And that's the funny part of the whole Ray Rice story also to me, is the fact that it wasn't ESPN, it wasn't Sports Illustrated, it wasn't Yahoo Sports or Fox Sports or any of the other ones.
Oh, no.
It was TMZ who uncovered this tape, which
right.
They say they got with a phone call and made it public and just sent the NFL into a tizzy and showed, really, I think, in a way, how they really operate.
Well, let's think about the NFL for a second. It's the only sports organization that can say this in North America. No other sports organization has a relationship with NBC, ABC through ESPN, Fox, CBS, you name it. I guess the only national outlet that they don't have a relationship with is PBS. And PBS was taught a very valuable lesson about a series they did when ESPN, though they let a couple of their guys participate in the situation, they completely backed off under pressure, you pointed out, from the NFL, which is part of this.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, the reason is, like you say, I mean, the NFL is funded, literally funded, because they get $6 billion out of their $10 billion a year in revenue comes from four of the five major media conglomerates in this country. And, I mean, I know that makes kind of everything sound conspiratorial when you say media conglomerate and all that, but that's what it is. I mean, there's five major companies that really run the media in the United States. Four of them are invested in the NFL, and literally to the tune of $1 billion or so apiece. And are you going to really risk that billion-dollar investment by revealing the dirt and grime of the NFL? Or are you going to just make everything seem happy and shiny and be fairy tale-like, because that's what sells? That's really what people want to hear more than anything, I think. And that's what's going to make everybody more money. And that's what these two entities are about, is making money. That's why they put on the games. I mean, they don't put the games on for free just for fun. They put on the games to make money. And that's what it's all about in the end.
Brian, you tackle officiating in this book. You talk about how there's the right call, and then there's the correct call. What's the difference?
Well, I think the right call is the one that the NFL wants, what's right for them. The correct call is what the rule book says. But the right call is the one that benefits the NFL or benefits a certain team that the NFL wants to do better than they should. I mean, we just saw this on the Monday Night Football game between the Seahawks and the Lions. And the final play that we're Calvin Johnson. There we go.
Megatron,
yeah. He fumbled right on the basically 6-inch line. The ball was bouncing through the end zone. Seahawks guy knocks it out of the back of the end zone, which it should have given the ball back to the Lions right on that 6-inch line, and they probably would have, I would assume, scored and win the game there, and yet that didn't happen. Despite the fact that there's an official sitting right there staring directly at the play when I think it's K.J. Wright for the Seahawks knocks the ball out of the end zone and he doesn't throw a flag. Now, if that official's job, and this is his job, is to know the NFL rule book, probably backward and forward, and then enforce those rules, how does he not throw that flag? I don't see how. I mean, that's your job. That's a foul. The guy did it. You saw him do it. I saw it in live time. It wasn't that it was being blocked or he was being, you know, distracted by something else. He's staring right at the play. How does he not throw a flag, and how does he not alter the way that game ended? And since he didn't do that, and the NFL came out exactly, I mean, literally within hours after the game and said, yeah, we goofed up, that should have been a foul, how is that guy still employed? Because he is still employed. He didn't lose his job. He didn't get downgraded. He's still officiating in the NFL. Yet he completely devastated the game. I mean, he completely changed the outcome of it, and yet he's not penalized for it. So does that mean, did he really screw up? In my opinion, maybe he didn't really screw up. Maybe that's actually what the NFL wanted. Did they wanted the Seahawks to win? And had Calvin Johnson got into the end zone and not fumbled, maybe a flag would have shown up somewhere, and a holding call or legal hands to the face or whatever other penalty they want to make up would have brought the Lions back out of the end zone and made him try it again. Because I think there's that sort of control within the league through their officials, and it's perfectly legal and perfectly legal for the league to do that if they want to.
What is your take on the veracity and credibility of Dean Blandino, who's been over the officials?
He's a weird story.
You're laughing at the mention of Dean Blandino's name. This isn't going to go well.
Well, as I found in researching the book, Dean Blandino was a stand-up comic for a while. Yet now he's the guy in charge of the NFL's officiating. And that's kind of an odd career track to take. Now, he never was an official. He was never an on-the-field official for any level of sport, ever.
What?
Never. He's the guy in charge. He's never been a referee. He was never a college referee, high school referee. He just managed to find a job within the NFL in their video department and started working through the instant replays. That's how he got his job. So here's the guy who's in charge of officiating, and he's never done the job before. And he's the guy who was seen, on the, the Cowboys Jerry Jones party bus, getting off the party bus and that sort of thing. I mean, he's not exactly the most upstanding of guy from what a lot of the public has seen of him. But he's just like Roger Goodell. I mean, Roger Goodell's never had another job besides working for the NFL in his entire life. He went right out of school into the NFL. So he's known nothing else but the NFL. And a lot of it's the same kind of with Blandino. All he's known is officiating and being in charge of officials, yet he's never done the job. And that's the guy we're relying on to tell us what's the right call, what's the wrong call, and how things should be, judged and managed. I find it incredible.
The worst part to me about watching it, the NFL, and I love the game, but the worst part, and I hate it, is replay.
the very thing that should make the game more level, more honest, is the thing that makes me question it that much more. And I don't know how that has come to be. You take us back to a couple of instances just from last football season. Both in the playoffs, both involved the Cowboys. In one case, it was that reversal when the Lions absolutely got jobbed, robbed, screwed, tattooed, and barbecued for the world to see. After a flag was picked up, you say that there was some kind of communication to the officials on the field in this book. I hadn't really heard that. And then they reversed the call. And then the second one involved the Cowboys the week after that, when what they call a foul, or a fumble with Dez Bryant is, or did they call it not a catch?
It was not a catch.
Utterly absurd. Utterly, I've been watching football for 40 years. That's been a catch for all 40 years. And now all of a sudden it's not a catch because, and here's what I love, and you make the point here. Mike Pereira, again, we're back to this whole culture of noise again. Mike Pereira in the booth says, oh, this is going to hold up. And then they come back on the field and they say, no catch. And then he's left to explain, but nobody remembers that he thought it was, because we have a culture of noise, and 5 seconds later everybody forgets what happens, which is what they're all counting on. I got wordy there, but your thoughts?
Well, I think you're right. I think more and more fans are starting to question what the heck's going on. Because when you have an HDTV like many people do now, and you can see things that clearly, and you can see, okay, this guy's foot is in bounds, and yet the referee comes back out in the field and tells you, nope, he was out of bounds, you have to say, what? How is that possible? And what I find frightening and kind of almost Orwellian is the fact now is that all the on-the-field officials are in direct communication with NFL headquarters. And every replay goes through NFL headquarters, which means it all goes through the former stand-up comic Dean Blandino. And so that's where I think you get these rulings. And I think, you know, part of it, too, is the very gray area of the NFL rule book. You know, what is a catch? What is not a catch? Well, like you said, you've been watching football for 40 years. I've been watching football just nearly as long. I don't know what a catch is anymore. Nobody can see
totally
it to define what it is. They don't know what's a football move.
Totally agree.
What's a football move? Who knows? So, therefore, they have this great gray area to actually manipulate games with. Because in the case of the Dez Bryant catch, they could have come out and said, that is a catch, first down on the one-yard line, you know, the Cowboys go and score, win, and go on to the next round to play the Seahawks. And everybody would have been fine.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, they could come out and say, that is not a catch. It's now Packers' ball because that was fourth down, and the Packers go on, and they go on to play the Seahawks. And most people are fine with that, too, because of this huge gray area. But yet when you see these replays, and you see what happens, and you don't even have to see them in slow motion. You just see what happens, and the NFL tells you that's not what happened. There's something wrong. And like I say, that's why I play with this whole idea of integrity in the book, is the fact that there's a lot of things in the NFL that they're really not being integrity about. You know, it's really not exactly what they're purporting to be. I mean, it's a very strange league, and they're allowed to get away with a lot of things. And the funny thing to me, too, is the fact that fans, I mean, they do care, but they don't care because, like you said, they forget 5 minutes later what just happened.
Well, you've got Pereira there as well. How many times do you watch a game and he'll say, they're going to uphold this, and then they overturn it? And then you've got the other guy that CBS uses. He's about as exciting dead pencil, as a pencil without any lead in it. That guy, and it seems like, I'm not going to say they're never right, but it seems like they miss a lot. So the point is, when the guys who are immersed in it, who are really well thought of, who are supposed to be experts, miss during these replays, then the nebulousness of the rule book, it has to be open to manipulation, the way they're interpreting these rules. It just has to be. That's logic.
Yeah. Oh, you're right. I mean, and that's what it boils down to. I mean, you look at something as simple as a holding call. I mean, for one official, that'll be a legal block. For another official, they'll throw a flag. I mean, and supposedly this occurs on every down holding. And yet you only see certain holding calls, you know, you see it called twice, three times a game sometimes. I mean, there's a whole, like I say, there's this whole gray area that is subjective, and that's allowed for the officials to make an on-the-fly determination about. But yet, even, like you say, when they get things absolutely wrong, and it happens almost every week, and almost every Tuesday the NFL comes out and will even say they goofed that up, they screwed that call up, they got this one wrong, they got that one wrong. They don't go back and change any results, and the referees don't get punished for what they did wrong. They keep, you know, what's that guy's name? Phil Luckett or whatever?
Yeah.
The guy who's been a referee forever, who's just screwed up so many calls, it's unbelievable. He's still ahead of an officiating crew. Now, if there's only 17 officiating crews in the United States, how is he one of the 17 best referees in this country?
Because it's not about making the correct call.
Exactly.
It's about making the right call. Love that. The conspiracy theorist in me, Brian, I leap for joy every time. The work that you're doing, continue to ask the questions. On the way out, do you think the common sports fan wants to know these things?
No, I don't think. I think they just want to be entertained. They want to sit down, watch their three-hour baseball game or football game or whatever, and just forget what's going on in the world. And I don't blame them, because unfortunately this world's getting weirder and weirder every day. But I don't think they want to know the reality of what it is they're watching, because that interferes with the whole fairy tale of it all. I mean, if you really stop and think about, I mean, and you hear it every time. I mean, fans go crazy and they complain and yell and scream and they get on Twitter and Facebook and I can't believe they screwed up that call and blah, blah, blah. And yet next week they're right back on their couch watching the same thing. And yet they never stop and think, well, wait a second. Did they really screw that call up? Or did they do that intentionally? Maybe because they wanted a certain result over another result. Fans don't want to hear that. They don't want to hear about the history. They don't want to hear about the criminals who are running this sport, the criminals that are playing the sport. They just want to be entertained, and they don't want to know. And I just want people to think. That's all I'm trying to do, is educate people and say, just look at it in a slightly different way, and maybe you'll see through some of this, and maybe it'll change how you feel about all this, and maybe that'll be a good thing.
Brian Toohey, I feel educated. A season in the abyss. Sports gambling versus the NFL's integrity. Brian Toohey, it's been amazing spending a few minutes with you today, or close to an hour, but I really do appreciate your time. Best of luck with the book. Also online at
thefixisin.net.
Brian, you scare me, because I don't know what's real and what's not anymore. And I'm a conspiracy theorist at heart, and you've really got me questioning a lot of what I see. And for that, I say congratulations. I think that's good stuff.
Well, thank you, Tony. I appreciate it, and I think it's a good thing. I think it's a good thing to ask questions, especially about a multi-billion-dollar industry, and you shouldn't listen to just what they say and just take it as gospel truth.
And don't trust the tout services.
No, same thing. Don't trust that billion-dollar industry either.
Brian Toohey, thank you.
Thank you.
Once again, the book is called A Season in the Abyss, Sports Gambling versus the NFL's Integrity. Brian Toohey, T-U-O-H-Y, and I thank him for joining us. I am so thrilled to have our next guest with us here today, because I've searched high and low in my sports reading life to find somebody that could get me close to Connie Mack, and Norman Macht has done exactly that in the third of his trilogy of books on the baseball icon, the grand old man of baseball, Connie Mack in his final years. It is fresh out from University of Nebraska Press, and Norman Macht now joins. And Norman, I was telling you in an email, and I want to welcome you to the program, but I was telling you in an email that as a young kid growing up in the early 70s, mid-70s, in that period in Philadelphia, there were still a good number of A's fans around, and it was an interesting time. You brought Connie Mack back to life for me. Thanks for doing that.
Oh, wow. I appreciate it. I had in mind for Volume 3, which covers 1932 to the end of his life in 56, a lot of my friends who remember seeing the A's, particularly in the 1940s, and for them, this was revisiting their youth, as well as for your father and other members of your family, it's going to bring back, I think, a lot of memories of their favorite players.
What I think is really remarkable about Connie Mack, and when you bring his name up in Philadelphia to those that were there, especially back then, now a lot of those folks have left us, but back then the narrative of Connie Mack was he had tremendous teams in the late 20s and early 30s, and he sold them for financial gain. The truth is, in reading your work, and this was illustrative to me, Norman, he sold those players to keep his franchise alive.
To stay in business, right.
I don't know how the narrative became he was a greedy guy that sold his players. Does that surprise you that that was the narrative?
No, because I found that once somebody writes something like that, like Connie Mack was a miser and tight and squeezed every nickel and sold players for his own benefit, other writers pick it up. It gets repeated, repeated, repeated until it's accepted as truth. And I knew that. And that's the reason that, that's one reason that these three books took me 30 years to finish, because I ignored everything that had been written in the past 50 years or 60 years about him and went to the original sources and talked to the people who worked for him, played for him, lived with him, and got what I consider to be an accurate portrait of the man.
What a tremendous service you did to those of us who love baseball history, to talk to so many folks who were there and who were around him and who remember him. And at times this book reads almost like an oral history would. Was that part of the design of Volume 3?
It was part of the consequence of the fact that so many more players were still alive when I was working on this from the 30s and 40s and early 50s than was true of the, say, you know, 1929, 30, 31 club. So I had the opportunity to talk to so many more players, and that's what gave it its sort of oral history aura.
As we talk today with Norman Macht, the grand old man of baseball, Connie Mack in his final years, 1932 to 1956, University of Nebraska Press, and this is a book that if you love the grand game of baseball, you love its history, you love a good story, you like to laugh, you like to cry, it's all in there in this work. Norman, of the three that you wrote, in that you immersed yourself so acutely into Connie Mack's life, in as much as you had these interviews available to you, I'm sure this was an easier one to write of the three, but at the same time, I would imagine it was extraordinarily difficult for you to revisit Connie Mack, as he not only struggled to keep his franchise alive, but he struggled himself health-wise through many of those years. I bet that was really difficult for you to write the third in the trilogy.
It was, I would say, more difficult for the living members of his family who really had no idea, many of them, of his deterioration during those years. A few of them saw it, but many of them did not. And actually the whole project has come as a great surprise to a lot of his descendants who never really knew him, or who never knew him as a young man, including his own children, because his second family didn't begin until he was around 50 years old. And so his children, his five children from his second marriage, never knew him as a young man, had no idea what he was like. So it was a great revelation to them, as well as to readers who never knew him.
I'll tell you what was really tough for me is knowing what kind of a standard bearer he was for baseball and knowing what kind of a contributor he was to the game, to see the game pass him by before his eyes financially, and to see how he would not reach out for help. Why was it that Connie didn't bring someone else into that ownership group, someone with deeper pockets, to help the A's and help them compete? What was it about his makeup that he just wasn't going to go that route?